I'm Valérie Legras, and you are listening to Textures. Textures is a podcast about art, design, and entrepreneurship. In each episode, I chat with artists, designers, creators, and innovators, the people who add textures to our world. In each episode, you will meet with creative minds, discover their world, their work, and how they made it happen. Texture is an informal and open conversation about living and leading a creative life. Today, I'm sharing with you a conversation I had with Sarah House. Sarah is a ceramic artist who works primarily in clay. We met at her studio here in New Orleans. Sarah House creates sculpture and functional works inspired by natural fractals. If you're like me, you are not aware, but we are surrounded by it. And maybe, just because like me, you do not really know what natural fractals are. This episode will open up your eyes. Sarah's creativity is a combination of her passion for both mathematics and nature. She earned her BFA from Tyler School of Art and her MFA from Tulane University. Her love for adventure led her to participate in Artists in Residence program in the US, Asia, Europe, and South America. She traveled the world in search of inspiration. Sarah works with different types of clay and porcelain, and she worked at many different scales, from very small item to large mural installation. Let's meet with Sarah House. Sarah, thank you for coming here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Sarah, can you tell us how you became a ceramic artist?
Sure. Well, I started taking classes at a local community college where I grew up in Baltimore. And I took painting and drawing and welding and woodworking. And the last class that I took was ceramics. And I really liked it. I really liked the community of people there. And so I just sort of stuck with it ever since.
Good. So you really tried many means of expression.
It's true. And when I transferred from that community college to art school in Philadelphia, I actually became a sculpture major. But the community around the sculpture department was not very welcoming for some reason. And I took an elective in ceramics. And the ceramics community, they were so warm and welcoming, and they convinced me to switch over because I could still make sculpture, but within the ceramics department. So then I left my major as a sculptor and went to ceramics, and I have no regrets.
So I didn't know anything before I went to your studio, you know, about ceramic, ceramic art before. And it's very physical. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really put your hands on, you're in direct contact with clay, dirt, and it's very intense, the connection between the artist and the material. Can you speak about it, you know, about the relationship you have with this material?
Sure. Well, I feel like that's part of why it's so satisfying, is because I am touching it. I feel like physically part of the process, and it feels that I'm almost more connected to it than if I was only making something with tools. If I was making a painting, for example, you know, there's the brush in between me and the art. But if I'm actually touching it with my hands and forming it with my hands, it feels more satisfying in some way that's sometimes hard to put words to, but it just seems like it makes sense to me.
And it's very, you were talking about having pens in your arms because you really have to get deep into the material and just make it take full possession of the material, and just mm-hmm. you and the material just become one.
Mm-hmm. It is you need certain amount of muscles to lift the work, loading the kilns, wedging the clay. It's heavy, it's dirty, you can break a sweat, and it's just very satisfying. I think it attracts a certain sort of person, you know.
So there is something very interesting when I went to your studio. So you're talking about the dirt and something very dirty, and you know, in another hand I saw some very refined porcelain pieces, and porcelain and clay, can you just speak about the difference?
Sure. Well, porcelain is a type of clay, but not all clay is porcelain. porcelain is a more refined type of clay. The particles are all very small. The particles are all very uniform and smooth. So you can get a certain level of detail with porcelain that you might not be able to get with a very groggy or rocky clay body. Porcelain also has the ability to be translucent if it's very thin. It has a certain sound. If you kind of ping it with your fingernail, it'll make a certain ring that other clays will not. So there's a certain level of refinement that is achievable with a porcelain that is harder to find in other clays. But there are other clays that you can kind of get away with some of that. You might not get the translucency, but you can get the smoothness, for example. Like the clay that I use is not porcelain. It's a lower fire clay, but it's very smooth, so I can get that nice, soft, smooth texture without needing to invest in very expensive clay and fire it to a very high temperature, which is also kind of expensive. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Did I answer your question?
No, okay. It does. But I notice you work with both, and mm-hmm. you know, just right now you're working on the other type of clay, but mm-hmm. that's why I wanted to ask you. And I also did not realize, but your work is extremely technical. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to think about how you're going to put things together, because you have weight and structure. It's basically like an architect or maybe a structural engineer. Mm-hmm. You have to maybe think of your foundation before. And I know there is other approach to the ceramic art that maybe you can also mention, you know, can just explain us.
Well, it is a super technical medium, which is why I think it requires a lot of schooling in order to master it in a way. Cracks can happen. Things can blow up in the kiln. You can get it all the way to the glazing stage, but then something is a malfunction in the glaze, or the kiln malfunctions, and then it's just, that's it.
So the kiln, this is like the oven.
That's the oven, yeah. If the kiln fires unevenly, maybe it's almost like a toaster oven will have coils. So those are called elements in a kiln, and you'll have maybe four rows. And my kiln has four rows of elements. And if one of them goes bad, you'll have a cold spot in a kiln, and then you may have a piece that fires halfway good and halfway bad. And sometimes you can fix that, but sometimes you can't. So it's even the most masterful ceramists will probably lose about 10% of what they make, just because of the material itself is so technical, and there can be small imperfections in the clay that you don't see until you fire it, and then that becomes a big crack. So it's very technical, and I think that's another reason that I'm so attracted to it, is because of the challenge, that not anybody can just pick up a piece of clay and make something that they want out of it. It takes a long time. It takes years of practice and learning different techniques and studying with different people. To be able to like fully express yourself through the material.
Yeah, and I didn't know that either. All your pieces have a little hole, mm-hmm. and most of the pieces are hollow. Mm-hmm. It's just because it doesn't crack or explode or implode.
Exactly. So if you have a solid piece of clay, say it's maybe 5 inches thick, right? It's not impossible to fire something like that, but it's very difficult, because there could be there's more likelihood that there's an imperfection within that chunk of clay that could become a crack later. You also want something to be lightweight for transporting. You want it to be dry all the way through before you can fire it. And if it's very thick, it can hold moisture in the center, because that water will turn to steam and blow up in the kiln. So, you know, you traditionally want something to be fairly even all the way around as far as thickness. You don't want to have areas that are super thick and areas that are super thin, because you want things to dry evenly, so there's no air bubbles, so there's no water, there's no moisture hiding that could become an explosion in the kiln later, which can damage other work. It can damage your kiln. So all of my work is hollow for firing purposes, for saving material. You know, you don't need it to be solid necessarily. To make sure that everything doesn't blow up in the kiln, hopefully that's the goal,
because,
right?
Yeah, it's about 2,000 degrees, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, the work that I'm firing to about 1980, so close to 2,000, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, 1980.
Pretty close, but it's a you know, just 30 degrees can be a big difference in a clay body.
But that's interesting because you turn clay into stone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we think stone, we think something very strong. Well, mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. not exactly it. Even though it's stone, it's still very fragile.
It's true. But if you think of if you had something made of stone that was maybe a quarter of an inch thick, you could still drop it. It would break. You know, it's this, you think of a stone that's solid all the way through, and that's what gives it its like weight and strength. So if you had a piece of clay that you fired solid, you know, you would be making a rock basically, and it would be just as strong as, you know, a rock that you would find outside. You know, it's my understanding that the process of making rocks, or the earth, how the earth makes rocks, is through the way that the crust is recycled, basically. You know, you're talking about like geological thinking here. You know, the dirt will go down into the center of the earth, right, where it heats up, and then it's pushed back up through volcanic eruption, and it's like we're this recycling rock is formed from dirt through the heat of our earth. And so I'm kind of mimicking that in a way by taking clay and heating it up very hot and turning it into rock.
And there is, I mean, we're talking about clay as a general word, but there is many, many mm-hmm. different type of clay, whether you are in Chile, whether you are in Belgium, mm-hmm. whether you are in, Antarctica. I mean, anywhere in the world, I mm-hmm. guess you have different type of clay mm-hmm. and the result of art or, you know, the pieces you come out, I don't know how to say that, but, you know, the different type of clay must definitely have an impact.
It's true. There's definitely indigenous clays around the world. Even nearby here, the coast of Alabama, there's a huge clay vein. You know, just like you might have a vein of quartz or coal, you can have veins of clay.
So ceramic, you know, is a very old craft, and it takes many forms, including tableware, tile, figurines, and other sculptures. And for millenniums, I believe, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, that artists used pretty much the same techniques. And now, you know, we have new technology like Rhino software, CNC, and it really changed the way of creating. Can mm-hmm. you explain what I saw in your studio was actually...
Yes,
testimony. Yes.
Well, I was lucky enough to get to take a workshop last summer at the Anderson Ranch Art Center in Colorado. And the workshop itself was on using Rhino as a means to create three-dimensional forms. So we designed forms in Rhino, and then we would 3D print them or CNC mill the forms out of foam. And then we would take those objects and then cast them in plaster and then make molds that we could then pour into with slip.
Yeah, I've seen the mold in your mm-hmm, studio, mm-hmm. and it's definitely a new approach. No?
Yeah. It's that's a good question. It's a fairly new way for ceramists to make art. It definitely has been used for longer in the process of tableware, making teacups and such. You know, toilets and bathtubs are used making molds, but I want to say maybe the last 40 years, and I may be wrong on that, so forgive me if I'm outing myself for not knowing my ceramics, my ceramic history, where artists started to use this technique of slip casting into plaster molds as a way to make sculpture. And using Rhino was really exciting for me because of the subject matter that I'm making work about, which is the mathematics of nature. And in the past, I've used platonic solids like dodecahedrons or even spheres, things that are very technically mathematical shapes, and multiplying them in many ways to create these organic forms based on mathematical shapes is a way to be, I don't know, maybe playful. It's very nerdy to be playful in this way, but kind of ironic. I'm making a fractal shape out of a Euclidean geometric form. Whereas in Rhino, I could kind of tap back into that a little bit because there are these forms that you can choose. You can choose a pyramid, you can choose a sphere, and I could multiply that and shrink it and almost curate and build forms using these shapes that existed in the program already.
So did it really help you to see things that you might have not think about before?
I think it helped me express an idea much quicker in a way that I think would be much more difficult for me to make by hand. So to make a perfect pyramid shape by hand would take days, whereas I could just select it on a computer and work through ideas quicker in a way that I wasn't spending all of my time on like a technical part of this process. I can spend my time more on the artistic expression part of the process, which is a little bit liberating in a way. So that's something that's exciting to me. Having this as a new possible avenue is the speed at which I can work through ideas in the studio, which is great. But I also, I don't want to just create a form in Rhino, CNC mill it, pour plaster, then use it and cast an object, and then boom, it's done. There still has to be some level of me cutting it, sculpting with it, building onto it with objects that I made by pinching the clay in my hands, because there's got to be that connection. If I'm just slip casting and then they're done, it's almost like I'm like a machine creating these forms and I'm not actually sculpting and forming with my hands, which is what brought me to ceramics in the first place, is that kind of physical connection. And I want to make sure I keep that or else I'll get bored.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah,
definitely. And I really invite our listener to go on Sarah's website and her Instagram, because you can see all the pieces we're talking about and also the installation. And you do a lot of, you know, wall art and installation. Can you speak about it?
Sure. I like using the wall to show work because it allows the work to become a bit more integrated into the space. It's more part of the room as opposed to sitting on a tabletop in a room. And I still like to make tabletop sculpture as well. But when it's on the wall, you can almost have more control over the angle at which it's viewed. If there's something, a pattern that I want to show that it might be very important for it to be looked at straight on vertically, then that would be the most appropriate way to show it. If it needs to be seen from all sides, then it would be more of a piece that's on a pedestal or a tabletop in the center of the room. So it's a nice option. It's also, you know, this reason is not super selfless, but it's easier for people to justify purchasing something that can go on the wall because they don't have to worry about the physical space of it in the room. But that's not on the forefront of my reasoning, but it's definitely an added bonus that there's typically more space on walls in private homes to show that type of work.
Yes,
but that's true. It's more about the experience of seeing the piece and having control over or how people experience it.
And Sarah, let's talk about your long art residency.
Sure.
And that's absolutely fascinating how many countries you visited. You basically traveled the entire globe.
Well, almost. I've been to 8 art residencies, several in the States, and the others have been in Europe, South America, and Asia. And an art residency is a really special thing. It's kind of, you're removing yourself from your comfort zone, and it's a designated time and space to focus on a project or even just to think. You know, I've used some art residencies as just time to draw ideas and think and not even make clay, just to be away from my normal routine in a new place and focus 100% of my time and energy on the ideas.
Which one, the last one you did was in?
The last art residency I did was in Chile. And last year I didn't do a residency. I went to the workshop in Anderson Ranch instead. So I've done a few that were very quick, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And the longest one I've done was in Baltimore, Baltimore Clayworks, and that was 2.5 years.
And can you tell us how you found this residency? Because I thought it was very smart.
Well, a few of them have been funded through grants that were competitive, that I would write an essay and submit images, and then I would win the money to then travel to these places. But most of them were funded through crowdsource campaigns. So my scheme, I call it a scheme, is to do a GoFundMe, and then for people who donate, there's different levels. So for $30, you would get maybe a pendant. For $100, a planter, and all of these art objects that I would make would be inspired by the residency. So there's an understanding that somebody is donating, and they might have to wait 10 months to get the object, because I would go to the place, come up with the idea, troubleshoot, maybe a few ideas don't work out, come up with an idea that works, that is inspired by the place, that fulfills my obligation for this reward level. And then it's almost like a homework assignment. You know, like I have to make 20 of these objects. And by the time I get to the 20th one, well, now I'm ready to make a big, serious art piece, because I've gone through all of these ideas, making these strange, weird objects that maybe are funny and little strange things that are great, but maybe I have to make 10 or 15 of these objects before I can really work out some ideas. So the people that donate to the GoFundMe, they get an art object. Then I get to receive funds to then do these art residencies. And then the act of making all of these gifts for these rewards, it kind of makes me do my homework assignment, and then I can create some bigger, serious art projects, you know, based on all of it.
Yeah, that's pretty smart.
Oh, well, thanks.
No, that's true. And your work is influenced by patterns found throughout nature, particularly the fractal patterns, and I really want you to talk about it, because that's fascinating.
Sure. So a fractal is a pattern that is self-similar. So that means that there are copies of itself within itself. So if you think of a head of broccoli, and you take off a broccoli floret, well, that looks like the whole head of the broccoli. And the broccoli floret, you can take a little piece off, and that looks like the floret, and that looks like the whole head. So a broccoli is one small example of the fractal mathematics of nature. And these patterns are everywhere, from clouds to mountains, to the way that fire and water move, to the our nervous system, to the way our lungs branch, to the way trees form and the way that river systems form, to even the structure of our universe itself. And we can't, of course, see the structure of our universe, but the leading scientists in this field are convinced that the structure of our universe is a fractal pattern. And so that makes me feel really excited, because it's almost this interconnection, like we're all connected through this pattern. You know, the way that my lungs branch are the same way that this tree outside is branching. And that's the same way that our galaxy is formed. So it's a way that we're all kind of connected to ourselves, to each other, to the environment that we're living in. And that makes me feel, I'm not a religious person, but that almost makes me feel like a similar feeling of like there's this bigger thing that we're all a part of. And that feels very beautiful and almost reassuring to me. So I'm making work inspired by this idea. But particularly, I like to use the imagery of like mountains and water and rock, because that's something that we can all connect to, because we're all living on this planet, right? And also, when we are experiencing nature, it's very calming. Our heart rate lowers, we become sharper, our memory becomes better if we just take a walk through the park. And if I can tap into that a little bit and make someone feel maybe relaxed or excited about the mathematics of nature, then I feel like I'm doing my job as a maker, as an artist.
Yeah, your work is very therapeutic when you work.
Oh, thank you. So then, good, I'm doing my job.
Yeah, you are, definitely. And, Talk to us about the when you went in Iceland, maybe.
Oh, yes. So this was a residency that I did maybe 4 years ago now, almost. Wow, that's crazy to think that it was that long. And it was I was thinking, okay, where in the world do I want to go? And I thought Iceland because of the dramatic beauty. There's something about mountains that just make me feel almost emotional, and being around them is very special to me. I know I live in the swamp now, but my heart is often in the mountains. And I've been really fascinated by glaciers and ice and just the beauty of them. And I wanted to see that in person. So I researched Icelandic art residencies. There are a lot. And I just applied to a bunch of them until I got into a handful. And then I chose which one I wanted to go to. And then I did the GoFundMe to fund it. And I spent most of the time traveling around, taking photos and making drawings and making plans. And seeing icebergs in person, it blew my mind. Because here is this form with these crazy patterns that somehow naturally have occurred that almost don't make sense. Like, you're looking at it like, how did that even happen? How did this ice make this crazy pattern? And it's as big as a house, and it's translucent and blue and white, and I've just never seen anything so beautiful in my life. And I was this, you know, crazy American tourist, like, crying on a boat at the icebergs. I probably looked insane, but it was awe-inspiring. And so I became a little bit obsessed with glaciers and icebergs. And that is what inspired my trip to go to Chile, because there are also glaciers in the south of Chile. So,
and it really reflects today in your art.
Yeah, you can really see all of those forms coming up. It really tapped into something. It's almost like I had been trying to make these forms for years. And then I didn't quite realize it. And then when I saw it in person, I thought, oh, this is what I've been trying to make, this object, and here it is, and it's huge and glorious. So it still is affecting what I'm making, even though it was just a handful of weeks, a handful of years ago, but it's still very much influencing what I'm doing. And there's also this ephemeral nature, right, to ice and glaciers, and they're disappearing. And it almost feels like I want to see them before they go, and to continue to making work inspired by them. You know, if I can get someone to care about nature, you know, that would be an added bonus of making art about it, you know.
And, you know, you're talking about the size of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it might be a little frustrating that in your art, sometimes you are limited by the oven.
Mm-hmm. The kiln. Yeah. That is a little bit, it is a little frustrating, but I try not to spend time being frustrated because I can't change it at the moment because it's the kiln that I have. So, you know, when I was in graduate school, I made the mistake of making a sculpture that was so big that I needed several people to help me move it. And it just felt so stupid. I said, why did I do this to myself? So now I'm making work that may take up a whole wall, but it's made of smaller pieces that I can move myself, that I don't need a team of people to move. I'm just not in the point of my career that I have a team that I can hire out to move the things that I'm making. So I've just adapted to, you know, the space and the kiln that I have. And I feel like I can still make larger work that maybe is assembled after it's been fired. So I can make pieces that are then, maybe they are just placed next to each other and they are one piece, but they're separate pieces, or I can even physically epoxy together forms to make larger pieces.
And it makes me think that, you know, what I really like in your work is the interaction between the forms, the shadows, the contrast between the form, the textures. And you can see that when you put different pieces next to each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And really makes sense.
Well, thank
you. What you're saying about, you know, just if you cannot do a big piece, then you just bring elements together and it still works beautifully.
And that makes sense because, you know, some of the ideas that I'm thinking about with this fractal mathematics is that whether it's tiny, you know, the branching of our brain cell is very tiny, but it looks just like the branching of a massive tree. And so you can still get the same visual feeling, right, if you scale down or scale up. So it shouldn't take too much away from it if it's slightly smaller, right? You just have to kind of get a little closer and zoom in, become a little more intimate with it.
It really makes sense. Yeah. And your work is represented in gallery here in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So can you let us know where?
Sure. There's a gallery on Magazine Street, and you might have to pronounce it for me because I will mispronounce it, being that it is in French.
So it's Atelier Mimi.
Yes, what she said. And it's on Magazine Street. And it's a new gallery, and it's, I believe, nine artists, ceramists, painters, fabric workers, and it's a really sweet space. I recommend it. And also the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. They have a gift shop that's called the Center for Southern Art and Craft, and they have some of my work as well.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
What is the next steps of your creative journey?
Well, my next steps are, this year I am focusing 100% on making larger work that will then beef up my portfolio again. You know, my scheme of doing GoFundMes to fund art residencies. Well, I will spend almost my entire year fulfilling those reward levels. So I'm spending maybe 10 months of my year making $100 objects. And although I'm grateful for people who have donated, and I'm grateful for having these residency experiences, it's almost, in a certain way, holding the ideas back slightly, because I'm spending so much time making small objects, and I'm not spending my time making big work, not caring how many hours it's taking, not thinking, oh, I have to make it in a small amount of time so I can charge a small amount of money so I can maybe sell it. So this year I'm focusing on making art for my portfolio that will then be used to apply for long-term art residencies next year, more competitive programs that will last for 12 months. So my plan is to apply next year, and hopefully I get into something exciting, and then my partner and myself will pick up and move for a year to wherever I get. I really miss being part of a ceramics community, and I really miss teaching clay. And so I would like to get that back again. So that's my plan.
Yeah, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks. I'm still here for another year and a half, and then we'll see.
I know you listen to a lot of podcasts. Can you just share with us, you know, your favorite ones?
Sure. Well, I listen to a lot of science podcasts. So my favorites right now are Hidden Brain and the TED Radio Hour. But I also really like Invisibilia. They don't always do science, but they sometimes do. And I also really like storytelling podcasts. So Snap Judgment is another favorite of mine.
Tara, thank you so much for coming to me today and for letting me visit your studio. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and you are always welcome in my studio.
A bientôt.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to Sarah for joining me on this episode of Textures. If you want to find out more about Sarah and her work, visit her website at sarahhouse.net and her Instagram at sarahhouseart. I will include all the links in the episode page. If you like this episode, subscribe to Textures on your favorite platform. Follow us on Instagram at textures.podcast or on my website at valerielegras.com/podcast. Take the time to review us, and do not hesitate to share it with your friend. Thank you so much for listening. À bientôt.